Welcome back, comedy fans and fans of general jocularity, to an all-new comedy at the Carlson Cast. Learn how to subscribe at carlsoncast.com. Today's episode, we're very excited. Mr. Jimmy Schubert is joining us. There he is. Look at that guy. He's glaring at you a little bit. Today's episode is, of course, brought to you by Sapori Cafe and Catering. Hey, Chef Joe from Sapori is teaming up with other Rochester favorites for the Roses Are Dead pop-up dinner at Silk Pub on February 17th. They got 3 chefs, 7 courses. Get more info on Facebook and Instagram at Sapori Rochester. Also, of course, we love Three Heads Brewing, the makers of Rochester's favorite beer. Do good things and always be kind. Now it's your host. He's an extra large husky. It's Vinny Paulino. Just learned that.
Did you call me a dog?
Yes.
Okay. a large furry animal.
He's a
yeah. That's about
he's a shapely up. Akita.
Yeah. Shapely Akita. Curvy Akita.
Curvy well, Akita.
Yeah. I'm proud to be husky.
Sure.
Well, it's the Carlson Cast. Joining us today, Jimmy Schubert.
Yes.
Brian, this is his third episode he's done with us.
Third one.
And I realized something as I was preparing for this show. There is a major part of his career that we have yet to touch on that I'm very excited to talk to him about today. For those of you who don't know, Jimmy Schubert not only is an amazing comic who's performing four shows here with us this weekend.
He's performing for shoes.
He's wearing at least 4 shoes.
He wears 4 shoes at once. Wrong.
He's working for shoes.
He's one of the original outlaws of comedy.
Yes.
With Sam Kinison.
Yeah.
How do we never get to that with him?
I know. I don't know either.
You know who I blame? Ross Johnson.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I'm excited because he's a great guest. There's a lot to talk about. And this is one of the more fun weekends we have here at the club. The crowds are great. They love coming to see Jimmy. It's an incredible show. Mm-hmm. If you've never seen him before, you need to get out here this weekend. So, are you excited, Brian? Are you going to come out to a show?
I am.
Excellent.
I am.
Excellent. So, also things that are going on. I have to announce this. I'm pretty happy about it. Play-to-Palooza is coming back up, boys.
Ooh.
Did you guys know that?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun last time.
Have you ever been to Play-to-Palooza, Ross?
I've never been to Play-to-Palooza.
Are you a garbage plate fan?
I'm a vegetarian, so I'm sort of not.
They do that.
Okay.
They actually have vegetarian plates.
All right.
There.
Mm-hmm. I can still eat a lot. It's not a volume issue. It's just a
Ross issue.
It's a composition issue.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I'm trying to pull up the... There it is. It is February 18th at 5 p.m., and you can get your tickets right now at carlsoncomedy.com. It's hosted by our friends at Stevens Media, Warren 101.3, The Zone, and all that good jazz. But you could get sample the best garbage plates in town. And if you saw Jim Gaffigan on the TV, you realize that's what we're known for now. We used to be known for Kodak. Now we're known for garbage plates.
Yep.
Which is kind of appropriate, really. It's a bit apropos, as they would say.
Yeah. A garbage plate is much more useful than a film camera.
No, I would disagree with that. I like film pictures.
Oh, Lord.
Really?
There we go.
Yeah.
This contrarian bullshit I got to listen to.
I like film pictures. I like the pictures on the film.
I prefer cassette tapes.
You used to have to drive to a little hut in the Ames parking lot, give them your film to develop. Only took an hour.
And a guy like Ross would...
I love how he's doing his old man voice and not just his voice.
It is a bit redundant.
It was completely redundant, yeah.
You know, I would like to read your Brian in an Ames parking lot fan fiction. You could submit that to carlsoncast@gmail.com. Any stories you like to write about Brian, little old Brian running around
the Ames parking lot?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to read mine.
Solid point.
Not on air.
Solid point. We'll save that. But the text line is open right now. If you have questions for Jimmy Schubert, feel free to text us 585-484-0265.
That's a big roll of film.
Yeah.
I have 3.
And then Schubert shows up with 4 shoes.
It's 4 shoes.
It's perfect. It's black and white.
All right. That's enough of this.
Yeah. Let's take a look at our upcoming promos, upcoming shows, and we'll be right back with Jimmy Schubert. So don't go away.
Hey, everybody. Got lots of cool shows coming up for your comedy at the Carlson. If you want to check us out, go to carlsoncomedy.com or call 5854-COMEDY for your tickets. We have this very weekend, tonight and tomorrow, Jimmy Schubert. And on February 6th through the 8th, we have Joelle Nicole Johnson. And Takara Williams on February 13th through the 15th. That's Valentine's Day weekend. Drew Michael, February 20th through 22nd. And hometown boy, Matt Griffo, February 21st. Very funny, unique show if you haven't seen that. And Jamie Lissau, another hometown boy, coming back March 5th through the 7th. Joel James on March 6th and 7th. And Faison Love on March 12th through the 14th. Can't wait to see that one myself, actually. Dan Viola's back again on March 13th through the 14th. And Steve-O, March 27th and 28th. You really want to get your tickets quick for that one. Those are going to go fast. Rich Scheidner on March 27th through the 28th. And the Sklar Brothers are back on April 2nd through the 4th. Another show that's really going to sell out really, really fast. And Diego Atanasio on April 10th in the Rickles Room, one night only. And we have Earl David Reed on April 16th through the 18th. He's always a great guy to have around. And we have Adam Ray, April 23rd through 25th. Ryan Nymiller, April 30th through May 2nd. And Mike Dambra on May 15th and 16th. Please come out and hang out with us at the shows. It's going to be a really good time. Again, if you need tickets, call carlsoncomedy.com or visit carlsoncomedy.com or call 5854-COMEDY. Use whichever way you want it to access it.
Y'all might be wondering why I'm smiling so big. It's because one of my all-time favorite comedians is sitting across from me right now on the couch. Ladies and gentlemen, Jimmy Schubert.
Hey, good morning,
for the man.
I'm already bowing down and worshiping. It's freaking Jimmy Schubert, ladies and gentlemen. One of our favorite guests, one of Rochester's favorite comedians, and you show that every time he comes through town because show up.
I like coming up here. I've been coming to this market for a long time, and it's just a lot of people know me, and I've been, you know, Weeze is like, you know, a beloved radio figure. So, I mean, I just love coming up to his show. You know, we're just... this is like a classic example of a club where I become friends with a lot of people just because you just come back every time. And so I love coming up here. And I love that the club's doing so well now. I mean, you know, I was with Mark through like the early club, the Comics Cafe, and what that was and how it's grown into this organization now, which I think is so much better. And what a great club.
It's a crazy road. Like, it's interesting that you brought that up. Not that anybody who's listening to this so much cares about the history of Rochester comedy, but boy, is it a really crazy road going from Comics Cafe to comedy at the Carlson.
Yeah, well, there was Yuck Yuck before that.
Right.
That was at the Ritz downtown, I think.
And
the
Andrew Street.
Yeah, and I remember one night it was a snowstorm, and there's probably about like 14 people in the audience, and I guess the guy in the front row had been drinking, and he like passes out, and the wife starts freaking out, and I'm on stage. There's only like 14 people there, and I said, "Is there a doctor in the house?" And this guy jumped across the table as a doctor. Apparently, the guy was like dehydrated, but he passed out at my show. And the paramedics come in and goes, "Oh, well, there's a guy's show that bad. Hey, I would have killed if you guys didn't show up, you know." But I go, and I kept going, "I've seen this before. He's trying to get out of the check. Make sure he pays the check. I've seen this before," as they're wheeling him out on the gurney. But just like, it was crazy, man, you know.
You almost killed.
I almost killed.
Almost killed.
Literally.
So, Jimmy.
Yes,
it's nice to have you back, like I said. And we've talked to you twice before.
Yeah.
And there is a major part of your career that we've never actually discussed. And I am so excited to have you here to discuss it. I'm just wondering, how did you get tapped to be one of the original outlaws of comedy? How did that happen?
That's a great story. You know, I was hanging out at the Comedy Store, and I was like, you know, I was a kid. Like, I was like... I got up there when I was 19. I was working the door. I mean, I literally...
What year are we talking, you said?
We're talking like 86, 87.
Okay.
And I had like, you know, I was like, I mean, I literally came in. I worked a whole summer out of high school. I saved about 10 grand. And I went to Los Angeles. And I was out there for about 2 weeks. And I know this because Andy Kaufman has been dead. Maybe, I don't know what he died, but like the character he created, Tony Clifton,
right,
was coming back to play the main room of the Comedy Store. People don't realize that Bob Zamuda was doing the character,
right,
long before Andy had stopped doing it, and Bob Zamuda was doing it. Yeah. And so
he would go out and do Letterman
as
Tony Clifton. Bob Zamuda would, and he'd think Letterman thought he had Andy Kaufman.
Yeah, and the great thing about it is that he was coming back, and it was a year after Andy Kaufman's death. And so they had this big affair, and they needed doormen. So I got tapped to be a doorman at the Comedy Store, and after that I became the runner of the Comedy Store, and I was getting spots on the weekends.
2 weeks into being in LA?
Yeah, I had I got a series of tapes called The Psychology of Winning by Dr. Dennis Waitley, and I listened to them over and over again as I was driving across the country, just drilling that information into my head.
Hold on.
And about 2 weeks after I got there, I kind of started my job. I showcased for Missy, and I didn't get hired as a paid regular because she thought I needed more work, which was fine. But like, and then I got a job as a doorman. And then once you become a doorman there, you come up through the system, you get to watch.
So let's backtrack for just a second, because this is a really, I'm fascinated so far by so many things. It's such an amazing time to be in LA at the Comedy Store.
Yeah, the original comedy boom. Although there's a comedy boom of sorts going on there now. I mean, it's just packed every night. They're sold out shows. I mean, it's and that's because of podcasts and everything now, and social media, because it's kind of have a resurgence, which is great for the Comedy Store, because there was a period in the 90s where I thought they may sell that property and that building may go away. But now it's a historical landmark site, so you can't sell it. And but it's great. I mean, they're killing it.
Now, how long were you doing stand-up comedy in Philadelphia before you went to LA?
About 2 years. But I had started doing magic. Like, I got a magic kit for Christmas when I was about 9. And I got really good. I mean, I was practicing. I was like an accomplished professional magician by the time I was like 14, 15. I was doing probably 6 shows a month.
Wow.
My dad had to like drive me to the gigs because I wasn't even old enough to drive. And like an oversized tuxedo and my shoebox with my doves in it with the holes in it and my magic case. And so I had been performing. I was just waiting for my writing ability to catch up to my performance thing. I always had a good stage presence, but my writing hadn't caught up to that yet. So.
Right, because you're young still, not a ton of life experience.
Yeah,
but you know, you got to kind of grow into yourself.
Well, actually, that's not true. I did. You know, I grew up with Philadelphia. I grew up with 5 brothers. I mean, I had I didn't have a horrible childhood. I just had a family, like a big family. You know,
sure.
And so there was, you know, my dad was a homicide detective, and it was a detective in the city of Philadelphia, and my brothers. And so, I mean, we were just always, it was great. You grew up with like 5 best friends, and we're always doing stuff, fishing. And I had a great life. I think about it all the time. And the problem is, like, you don't have any concept of nostalgia while you're living in it.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Until you get older and you go back.
What's normal to you as a child, when you look back at it as an adult, like, what were my parents thinking? You know what I mean? That's what I mean by like that experience of like realizing that maybe this was a little unique and other people haven't lived this.
Well, yeah, but I mean, so I've been performing in front of people for a long time. So when I got out there, I knew I wanted to do this. I mean, it was something I was working towards as a teenager, you know?
So you threw in your self-help tapes.
Yeah, well, I also went to a magnet school and went to the Creative and Performing Arts High School in Philadelphia, and I majored in drama. We had 3 drama classes a day, and it was like a regular high school, except I had dance and drama and all the arts, and people doing sculpting and painting.
Did children just burst into song in the hallway and choreograph routines like they do on television?
No.
No, that doesn't happen?
No, I'm sorry.
My dreams are
shattered. Are there videos of you singing and dancing anywhere?
No, there's barely any of me doing magic. I had a couple photos of me doing magic, but I used to do magic at every chance I got. I would go door to door and do magic because I wanted to get good enough to do it.
You did go door to door?
Yeah, my brother's married to a girl named Sonia Minky. And like her mom would go, oh, Jimmy Schubert's here for the afternoon magic show. And I would go and do a knock, and I would just go in and I would perform a couple magic tricks just to get good enough. It's so funny, but that's how nuts. I mean, I knew what I was going to do.
That's
yeah.
Ballsy.
Yeah, I'll go do it during magic.
Okay. You know what? Normally, I wouldn't want to. I don't like it when people knock on my door, but if somebody just bursts in and starts doing magic tricks, I'd probably be okay with it.
It was different times, though, man. It was different times. But
yeah.
So I did it, and then. Is there any water around?
Can I absolutely. Would somebody grab Jimmy some water?
So
was there ever a time where like a magic trick bombed and you just started Christmas caroling? Like just to get over, like a trick didn't work? You're like, oh, call all ye faithful.
Well, you know, I was just very motivated. I knew what I wanted to do and I had to. I just was kind of dead set on it, very focused. And so I got out there, I was doing stand-up, like, every chance I got, I could do, on a Monday night, you could do 5 spots. You could do one at the Natural Fudge, then you would shoot over to Westwood to the Monty Steakhouse, which was on the top floor. Me and Noodles Levinstein drove Paulie to his first stand-up gigs, and then I would run down
Paulie Shore?
Yeah, Paulie Shore.
Little Paulie.
And then I would run down to the Alley Cat Bistro, you could do a set there. about 20 minutes. Then we would run up to the Silver Screen Jazz Room, which is right next to the Comedy Store. They did a comedy night, and then you go over to the Comedy Store for a late night spot. Wow. And so that's all I cared about. It's all I was doing. I was writing during the day. I was working my day job to pay my bills, and I was going out and doing stand-up comedy every night, all night, between the L.A. Cabaret, the Laugh Factory, and just doing the circuit. It's all I cared about. I didn't care about anything else.
So you're in L.A.
Yeah.
You're, you know, nose to the grindstone. You have this incredible work ethic. You're getting on stage every time you can. Where does Kinison come into this? Where does
he walk
in? Well,
they were all hanging out. I mean, everybody was kind of hanging out there. It was like, you know, Dice was hanging out there. I mean, I was pretty friendly with Dice and Sam. And, you know, I first started hanging out with Dice because I worked with him in Philly. You know, I came back out and stuff, and we were kind of palling around. And then, you know, Sam was like, I drove Sam off stage on the main room on the motorcycle one night. He was there. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I just kind of, someone goes, are you going to drive your motorcycle out there? I go, I don't know. He goes, well, no one's ever done it before. And I go, well, you didn't have to tell me that. So now I can drive my motorcycle out there. He goes, wait a second. Before you go out, you need a joke. He goes, just go up and say it's last call. By the way, your ride's here, which is what I did. And I didn't realize Sam was scared to death of motorcycles. And he jumped on the back, and we just kind of drove him off stage right up out the back and down on the Sunset Boulevard. And he turned around on La Cienega and headed back down. About 40 people came running out of the building. We're on the sidewalk. And they were applauding, and I just kind of pulled up, and he jumped off, and I zoomed off because I had to go work. But I didn't realize how cool that was until he, like 2 weeks later, I go to the Comedy Store, and I hear, Jimmy Schubert, get over here, you crazy motherfucker. And he's standing with Lorraine Newman and Randy Quaid, who were both on Saturday Night Live at the time. And he told that story, and he told it so much cooler than it was. Like, wow, it sounds pretty cool.
He played it up.
Yeah, I feel like Kinison was really good at, like, creating a scene.
Yeah, and so when he was getting ready to go out, and he wasn't famous then. I mean, he had this kind of cult following, but he wasn't famous. But when he did become famous and he went on tour, he asked me if I wanted to go. I was one of the guys. He goes, you want to go? And it was Mitchell Walters, Alan Stevens, Carl LeBeau, and I was like this young kid that got the chance to tour all 70 cities with one of the most controversial comedians in America at the time. And it was a blast.
How many cities?
70.
70, wow.
On a tour bus.
Yeah. That must have been some interesting late nights on that tour bus.
Yeah.
Listen.
I can see that smile of glee on your
face. I care very much about your career, but I have to ask you this about Kinison, because I'm really fascinated by him.
Yeah.
And I'm not asking you for dirt. I just want to know, what kind of changes did you see in him as a person from when you first, you know, you knew him when you first got there to while you're on the road with him for, you know, he toured with the Outlaws Comedy, what, about 5 years?
Yeah, about 5 years. Well, first off, Sam was just a beast. I mean, he was I loved getting to watch his process, like every night. Like, I'd watch him go out and work on new stuff and put stuff together. But he was always like, you know, once you do something on TV, it's done. It's dead. Bury it. Write some new stuff.
100%.
And I just love, that's where I learned how to do it. When I did my Comedy Central special, I remember Sam was telling me when he taped his HBO special, Sam was about, when he did the Rodney Dangerfield Young Comedian special, he went in and went over every line, every word with the director and said, this is a, and so when I went to do my Comedy Central special, I remember that he said, I sat with him. I made the appointment and said, whatever, every piece of bit, are we going to shoot this bit? Well, come in on my face because I do this Larry thing. And then the conjugal twin bits, they're going to let me finger bang the midget. He goes, no, we're not going to be able to shoot it. I said, well, I'd be able to reach out a frame so the people in the audience can see it, but the people at home could not. He goes, that I can do. And so I was able to, they shot completely around the conjugal twin bit, which made that, I mean, that bit really kind of, I don't care what anybody says. A lot of people have reached out to me and said, that is one of the most original pieces of comedy and one of the most hilarious pieces. To this day, that's one of the top five bits. I mean, people just.
What did I say to you when you walked off stage last night?
Yeah.
Holy shit, the conjoined twin bit.
Yeah.
I never heard you do it before.
Yeah, I don't usually do it, but I started. My brother Joey was telling me, because you got to get that people do, because everybody tells me how funny that bit is. You never do it live. I go, because I'm always working on new stuff. I mean, probably that set I did last night, I did like an hour, but probably like 30 minutes of that is brand new, like stuff I'm just kind of playing around with, you know. But
it's definitely one of the ones you're definitely known for.
Yeah. So
I never seen you do it live, and I was crying.
Yeah. I have to go back and watch it and get, you know. But I got a new album coming out called Zero Tolerance, which goes with my special. That's getting ready to drop very soon. And, you know, I'm looking forward to it. I'm kind of excited.
I will tell you this, folks. If you're a Jimmy Schubert fan, you're going to be here this weekend already. But you do have that special available. You have it through a special download, which is awesome.
Yeah, well, I have those download cards. But yeah. Also, people can just go to my website, jimmyschubert.com. On the Vimeo platform, you can rent it for like $3.99 if you have Vimeo, and then you can buy it for $9.99. It just lives in your Vimeo account. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I produced it myself, so I'd like to at least get my money back. And once I get my money back, I'm just going to put it out on YouTube because I think it's a killer special. It's a great special.
If you don't mind me asking, because I think a lot of aspiring comedians who want to do something like that would want to know, how much does it cost to produce something like that?
I know a lot about post-production because I've done my specials before. I produced my last one. And, you know, it's like, and the great thing is that you can do that now. But I'm not waiting for, you know, a company like Netflix or HBO to go, hey, yeah, we think you're fine. Because it's ridiculous. It really is. I mean, when I was trying to sell my special, I ran into a lot of this, you know. We loved your special. We were not, if you were a minority, we would have bought it. I go, well, I'm not. It's really unfair to say that to me. Mm-hmm. I go, did you watch the special? They go, oh, we watched a couple minutes of it. And then Comedy Dynamics, this other company, which is like, you know, we love your special. I go, well, what's the offer? They go, well, look, we'll give you $3,000. They said you gotta pay the $3,000. They said to me, he said, you gotta pay the $3,000 errors and omissions insurance. It's called E&O insurance in case anything in your special, anybody can sue you. You're covered for the cost. It's called E&O insurance, and which I know they already have anyway because they're a broadcast company.
Right. They're trying to get you to flip the bill.
Yeah. And then he said, well, you know, we'll put it on a Roku channel and we'll give you half. I go, wow, you guys would do that for me? I mean, like, what do you think? I'm mentally encumbered? I mean, I'm not doing all the work.
Half of your Roku channel. Thank you.
I'm not doing all the work and then giving you 50% of it. It's like, to me, it was the most.
Yeah.
It's like, it's they insulting. Think you're an idiot. Yeah. Like today, that you got to write the hour. You know, you got to shoot the hour. You got to do the post-production on the hour. And then they'll go, hey, give me half. And my record distributor, a stand-up record, said, he goes, you'd be surprised at how many people take that offer all day long. Yeah. You don't get 50% of something you didn't have anything to do with. I don't care. So I said, I'm not.
You pay 50% for distribution is nuts.
Yeah. Well, they can't do anything that my distributor can't do. That was the thing that got me. And so me and him just went 50-50 on it, and so now you can go right to my website and you can download it there. I have those download cards. My buddy Ian Rands produces those on a company called Pixel Clicks, which is where your special lives. They buy those codes, they put that code in, and once the code's in, it attaches to your phone, so you can just go back and watch it anytime you want.
That's awesome. Huh? You're doing some really cool stuff. You just got back from India.
Yeah.
You're traveling with Russell Peters.
Which was amazing, man. Russell's a great guy. Russell was a judge on the last Comic Standing the year I was there, and I always loved Russell because he was very kind to me, and besides, he was one of the few judges that was actually going out and doing stand-up comedy. Roseanne hadn't done it in a number of years, and Keenan Ivory Raines was more of a producer than a stand-up. His brother Damon was always funnier, I thought. Right. But Russell,
we're Marlon fans around here.
Yeah. So he just said some great stuff to me, and so I was a fan. And he goes, "Hey, when are we going to work together?" And then he said, "Hey, I got a date. You want to come to Vegas with me?" And then we did Vegas. And he goes, "Dude, you want to come to India?" And I go, "Yeah." And so I had to get shots. I had to get, you know, you can't just go.
It's a thing going to India.
Like, how long did it take you to prepare to be able to go to India?
About 30 days, because you got to get the shots. We were thinking about going to Nigeria, like that was a stop on the tour, because then you would have had to get, you know, you would have had to take the malaria medication, you would have to take and stuff.
If you do go to Nigeria, you need to do me a favor. There's a prince there who apparently has an account for me.
Yeah,
if you could help me cut out the middleman.
Yeah, that's
I'm going to send my man.
I thought it was going to be my opening joke. Listen, I don't know which one is the prince of Ukubagidini, but you owe me $100,000. All right, that was going to be my joke.
Something about an account, help me out.
Yeah, I said when I was in Ahmedabad, India, which is where they do like Google and like have like 20,000 jobs there, Amazon.
Yeah,
so that's a really developing part in India. But I said, hey, I don't know what's one. It's nice to see, put faces to the names. You guys always help me with my technical. And they thought that was funny. Like, you always do my IC.
Lucy, Cindy, yeah.
Which
John.
One of these is Benjamin Franklin? Yeah. But it was great, you know, because it's like, you know, you're going to another country where English isn't their first language. Mm-hmm. And stand-up comedy is like jazz music. It's a uniquely American art form. And so it's not something they grew up with. But Russell Peters has been going there for 10 years and cultivating these markets. And I mean, he just to watch him with his audience.
How big of a venue is Russell Peters playing in India?
6,000.
Wow.
6,000. Wow. And you're doing like, but you know, it did, like, you know, in Hong Kong, he did like, I think four shows in Hong Kong, $6,000, like 6,000, like, yeah. 12,000 people a night. Like, did two shows. Yeah. I mean, it crazy. But they love Russell Peters. I mean, he's somebody that looks like them, that's very successful, and he's funny. And bravo to him, because he's actually really kind of cultivated this international. Russell Peters is a real international superstar. Yeah. He is a gem of a human being. He is as generous and sweet as anybody, a man. And he's a DJ. You know, he likes to do DJ. So he gave me all these great mixtapes while we were over there. I didn't know I was such a yacht rocker, bro. He gave me these, like, but he was explaining about the culture and the food and everything. And he was helping me with my stand-up.
He's like the new Bourdain.
I go, do you think this would work? Or do you think this would work? Because he really does know his audience.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, do it like this or do it like this. And he was helping me do some tags.
Yeah, I was going to say, you'd have to kind of, like, want to pick his brain to prepare your material.
Well, dude,
for that
I flew for 24 straight hours. When I landed, my head was swollen. And, you know, just because of, like, spending a lot of time on an airplane. Yeah. And so you, like, jet lag. You feel like it's sucker punched in the back of the head. And he goes, just go out. And I was nervous because I didn't know what they would laugh at. I mean, I tried to work a little broader. Like, here in America, you can be very specific with stuff because that's where God is in the details, not what's making it funnier. But over there, you kind of got to open it up a little bit and make it accessible. And so I had done China shows, but that was really a unique experience. That was really cool. The food was amazing. It really was. I mean, I make fun of it, but it was great. The whole trip was amazing, man.
Yeah.
I mean,
I've always wanted to go to India. You know what I like about Sud? I think you, as a comedian, you'll think the same thing. What I like about being in a country that's so foreign, you're walking around, you can't understand what anybody's saying. It's almost kind of like meditative, where you're just walking around the street.
Russell Peters shot his special over there, his new special on Amazon. It's called Deported. So people should go check that out.
I didn't realize he shot that there.
I did the hamburger press bit in India because I was an idiot. I didn't even realize that they didn't.
No, you didn't.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. So he was going, yeah, I wouldn't do that bit. I would dump that one.
Well, nobody's perfect.
Nobody didn't run that one by Russell.
In all fairness, Russell did say, he just got off a flight 3 hours ago, people. You know, I want to get off a flight for then after 24 hours of straight flying.
Yeah.
I was a little loopy. I'm not going to lie to you because it's almost 24 hours of straight flying. Yeah.
How much time did you spend in India once you got there? How long were you there?
About 14 days.
14 days, two weeks.
Yeah, about 14 days. We we were trying, like, it was running and gunning. Like, we, you know, get to Pune. We did a show there. We had a day off. The next day we went to Ahmedabad. And did a show there, had a day off. Then we went to Hyderabad, did a show there, had a day off. Mm-hmm. Then we went over to Bombay, and we were probably there for like 2-3 days, and then Mumbai, and and then we went to Kuwait. We did a show in Kuwait, and they're gonna hate me because, you know, they were sitting in the lunch in traditional Arab garb, but that was my favorite show. They were just like, they loved it.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, wow. Yeah,
it's so amazing. Like, we have such a an idea of what people are in other countries, and when you go there and you're actually performing your art in front of them, and to watch them receive it well, has got to be incredible.
Well, yeah, because they appreciate it. It's kind of and here in America, people get drunk. You suck, you know. People heckle you over there. They're kind of fascinated by it, and the internet really has made the world a smaller place.
I think you in particular are. It would be fascinating to someone from another country because you, to me, if I had to picture like an American, you're a loud person, you're very opinionated, you're out there and you have pulled no punches. Like there's like the air of pretending to be nice and stuff like that is gone with you.
That's only on stage. I mean,
I know, but what did they watch? They watched you on stage.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. No, it's funny, but you know, a lot of people, I mean, the mistake people would make was like, you know, confusing me with the character I do on stage. I mean, I'm really kind of like a, you know, I guess I'm a little bit like that sometimes. I guess you got to catch me in the right.
You turn it up a little bit on stage, but you're you, Jimmy. You're you all the time.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm kind of like, you know, I'm not like. I'm kind of like off stage. I'm kind of like low key. I'm like, oh, you know.
Yeah, you're not screaming at people.
No, you're right. I'm an idiot. Yeah. I'm a typical American. I'm loud. I'm obnoxious. And I'm opinionated. You're right. No, you're right.
You're everything that they hate about us, and there you are on the stage for them to.
And I'm also everything that they love about us. Yeah. You know
that they don't want to say they love about us.
And that's the other part of it. It's got to be refreshing for them to see someone out there just completely letting you loose the way you
let
loose.
Well, it's funny.
Come on.
I mean, like, that first night was a little rough, and it didn't bother me. Like, people, like, I was just going through the bits, and I started figuring it out, and I wound up doing, like, 20 minutes, but I was like, if a bit was kind of dying, that's a great thing about having so much material, I would jump into this bit and jump into that bit, and so it was fine. But the therapy cat bit was great. They got that. They got that a lot. You know, that's what I love about being over here. Nobody needs an animal to fly. And I made it about them. And then I started making about the food, which was great. Because I'm a white guy. I can't handle the spice. It's hot. It was hot. You people have a tan. You have pigment. I don't have any. Yeah. The sun could kill me. You know, and so I needed, like, you know, like, the only way I can go outside is like SPF. I had to walk around with a freaking, you know, so.
SPF house paint.
Yeah. That's what you need. That's exactly.
You Irishman.
Yeah, SPF house paint.
Yeah. I wouldn't open with it. Pop quiz. Tell me about the worst audience member you've ever seen.
You know, it's interesting. Yeah, there was a, you know, people that just, you know what I hate? I hate people that have this, like, they have this like self-importance, like they think they can ruin a show. Like, I don't mind hecklers even going back and forth and bantering, as long as it's give and take. But some people just want to ruin the show for everybody else that's there. They think you should be able to handle anything. I go, listen, you're not affecting me. I don't care about me. I mean, you're not gonna. I mean, I get it, but I care about, like, you know, maybe there's a couple who had a baby 2 years ago. They found a babysitter they can trust, and they had to sit behind you, and you just won't stop yelling and ruin the show, and you won't let me get on a momentum, because I think stand-up comedy, like jazz music, has a rhythm to it. And once you get a crowd going, pop, 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 you know, you get the rhythm and you get the people, you can get them laughing, and you get them kind of rocking back and forth. And that's the way I like. I'm also like, you know, just joke, punchlines. And so, I mean, I like to get the audience on a rhythm.
When you're when you're doing jokes and you're throwing them out, they call it obviously the laughs per minute thing. When you're just shooting out your jokes, and when anybody says anything, not only do they halt the momentum, they may have just stepped on the punchline and then nobody hears it.
Yeah, so I think, you know, I don't mind, like, people that get a little too drunk.
A good-natured drunk is great for a comedy show.
Yeah, exactly.
But don't try it at home, please.
Yeah, but yeah.
Please
but
don't experiment during our shows.
I just, you know, that everybody has a sense of entitlement, and they think that they can do whatever they want, and you got to be. And I just go, no, you're wrong. You're not going to bother me. I get a fresh audience again either later tonight or tomorrow. So I won't even think about this. But you did ruin everybody else's night. So that's what it's about me. I like, you know, and that's happened a couple times. And sometimes I should just let it go. Like, I was so proud of myself. I did 3 shows last Saturday night. I was in Portland, and this lady was in the front row. She was dressed like a drag queen. And so she needed, like, and she would not shut up. Mm-hmm. And she wanted me to address. She was like, I could tell she wanted me to engage her. And I just never did. Mm-hmm. I just said, I'm doing 45 minutes and I'm getting the hell out of here. And I would address you, but I'm not going to, because it's going to stop my show, and I'm going to have to rebuild momentum. And I'm just going to keep barreling through it. I was really proud of myself, but I literally wanted to just kick her right in the head. I mean, I want to take 3 steps and just kick her right in the throat, and just watch her squirm around doing it. I mean, I have these fantasies in my head, like when you get somebody, like, I just have this fantasy, like, in my mind. I'm like unholstering a .357. I pull back the hammer and I just pop around into her skull and rupture it like a watermelon at a Gallagher show. I have this, you know, and everybody pulls up the plastic. And
like in a really hacky
way?
Yeah,
no, no, no.
Why do you drive in a parkway and park in a parkway? Splat!
Yes, but and then everybody behind you pulls up the plastic and there's just brain matter on it and they're just ha, 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 you know, and no one even cares that I just ruptured her skull with a 357.
I'd go to that show.
You know, those are the kind of people I can't stand. But, you know, I don't mind hecklers. I don't mind going back and forth. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, it's so funny. I have this heckle line. It was this lady in the front row who said something to me. I go, hey, lady, I got a rule. You can't yell at me unless I'm fucking you. And she goes, oh, I bet you get yelled at a lot. And I just thought that was fucking
That's
hilarious.
Great.
I just thought it was hilarious. And so...
Not as often as I feel I should be yelled at, actually.
Actually, I was yelling at myself this afternoon. Now, listen.
I'm very disappointed in you, Jimmy.
No, but she... Now, it's funny because I'll use that line. And I know what you people are thinking. I get yelled at a lot, you know.
Yeah.
We got a great comment in from a viewer. And yeah. I thought you might want to hear this. They said, wow, what a great guy. He cares about the audience. We are the couple that goes out once a month. We have 6 kids. We look forward to the night out. People need to not talk during the show. Completely agreed.
No, that's, yeah. See, and it's funny because here's what the dynamic of it is this. The dynamic of it is if you go after an audience member, the whole audience, even though it comprised of like, you know, 207 individuals, it functions as one organism. And so if you go after one audience member, the whole audience is going to go, they think you're going to go after them. You have to let that heckler annoy all the people around them. You look at them once.
You look at them
once, give them, and then you can remove them with a little bit of verbal laser surgery and isolate him and separate him from everybody else. But I absolutely care about the audience experience. I do. I work so hard on my act because I want everybody to have a great time. And then when you get these fucking hecklers, you're not ruining my night. You're ruining this guy's night that has his 6 kids. It's his one fucking night out a week.
Yeah.
And he just gets to sit behind you as a fucking, and you're an asshole and you are completely inconsiderate. And I always make it about the audience. I go, look, maybe some of these other people came out to see some comedy tonight. Maybe they didn't come here to see a fucking drunk douchebag just fucking yell throughout the show. And I just think those kind of people, they should just remove them from the audience. Get them fuck out immediately.
That's a really good way to look at it.
Because it just fucks up everybody's show. Yeah. Nobody works harder than me on stage. And I do it because I care about the audience. I want people laughing. I want them to walk out and go, that was the funniest shit I've ever seen. I want them to have a great night out. You know, I mean, and that's because, you know, I grew up with, you know, touring with, watching like Kinison and Carlin and Pryor and Robin Williams and watching these great fucking comedians. I mean, I was schooled there. I mean, that's the one thing about the Comedy Store. That was like my college. You know, that was my college. That was...
There's not a better one. That's like Harvard for stand-up.
Yeah,
really.
Essentially it
it's
is.
Ivy League.
Well, they got a Mike Binder, who was a stand-up comedy, who's now a director, is like a 4-part miniseries documentary about the Comedy Store. It's coming out, I think in September.
No fooling.
Yeah, he's been working on it. I just ran into
him. He's got a deal with HBO. Doesn't he do a lot of stuff for HBO?
Yeah. Well, he's also did that movie with Bill Burr, Black and White, with Kevin Costner.
Right.
I mean, he's also, I think, Pink Cadillac. I mean, Mike's a real, really good director. He writes and produces stuff. He works with Costner.
People forget he was a comic.
I think. He was a great comic. He was like one of the youngest comics out there. I mean, you know, he knows all these guys. But I mean, that was around during the strike, and that was like before I got there. But you know, there was a place called, they had a Comedy Store in Westwood, and I missed all that. But you were
a little past the strike.
Yeah, I was past the strike, and all that stuff already got worked out.
Yeah.
And, you know, people don't realize, because those comedians, there's a book called I'm Dying Up Here, and there's another one called, I think it's called The Green Room. They're both excellent reads about that stand-up here, comedy in that era, and they kind of complement each other. Mm-hmm. And the thing that is that people don't realize, because those comedians, even though they were striking for like $25 a night or... they were striking to get paid.
According to Jimmy Walker, they were asking for $5 a set.
Yeah, well, that's what it was. But the implications of that were bigger across the country.
100%.
And now, it's like people don't realize, in L.A., you know, you make it like, you know, now, like, you know, you go to the improv, you get, like, on a weekend and it's sold out, you get $200. But the implications were bigger because now you can travel and make a living doing it, and which is what everybody did anyway. It's really tough to make a living in LA. I mean, you guys are podcasting now and doing other stuff, so some of them have monetized that, but it really is like, you know, I didn't grow up in that era. I grew up, you had to go on the road to make a living, which is what I've done. And I'm a road dog, man. I'm a journeyman road dog. I mean, I would go out and I just love my job. I love making people laugh. So I'm not bitter. I'm not jaded. My career is my career. I've had an amazing life. I really believe very lucky.
Now, you're definitely luckier than Brian, because he would kill somebody for $5 a set. This guy.
I wouldn't kill him. Might kneecap somebody.
Hand jobs.
No, those are 15, Vinny. You know that.
Okay. You also act. You've been in movies, you've been on television. Have you ever tried out for anything and been like really bummed that you haven't gotten it? Was there like a part that you really thought was yours?
Yeah, I try to, when I go in an audition, I try to get everything I can win an audition for. Like some of the stuff I go out, they're not looking for me, but lots of times they don't know what they're looking for until you bring it in.
Have you read for stuff that's just completely not you?
Yeah, but I never, they're not looking for me anyway. I got nothing to lose here.
Right.
So if I can go and do something really creative with it, I happen to be a great auditioner. Mm-hmm. I would say I'm a pretty decent actor, but I'm a really good auditioner, and that's a special skill set. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to audition well to get the jobs.
Yes.
And some people are great actors, but they can't audition well. And I actually studied with a woman named Karen West, who was she spells it C-A-R-Y-N, but she's a Broadway actress that teaches a class in Los Angeles. With a girl named Jessica Kubianski, who's a monster theater director. And together they teach this amazing acting class. But Karen is a Broadway actress. I mean, every time I turn on my TV, I see her. But her class is about auditioning skills technique, about the only thing you have control over when you go into audition is your audition. You don't have control over everything else. So just focus on what you have control over, because they don't know what they're looking for until you bring it in.
Yeah.
And they want you to win. They want to go, finally.
We go home.
And so, but you know, you're reading against 300 people to 500 people for a job. I mean, you look at, like, you know, some of these movies, like I played the soccer coach in 1 Hour Photo. I mean, my manager picked me up at the airport and drove me to that audition because it's the only way I would make it. And I wound up getting the fucking job. But my manager also got me a development deal. And there was a couple of years where we were looking to do a pilot. And I did. I did a bunch of pilots. They just never got picked
up. If you if you were going to pitch a show right now, what do you think you'd want to do a show about?
Well, I would say I would do an animated show.
No fooling.
Yeah, I would do an animated show called The Dead End Gang, about growing up with six brothers in Philadelphia in the 1970s, with a dad who was a homicide cop and a mom who was a school teacher and very active. And just the whole show would be about, you know, the lessons from a father to a son, from a brother to a brother, from the street to the smart, but also as a backdrop with the 70s, with, you know, the Vietnam War, and Nixon was getting impeached. It's very like the more things change, the more they stay the same. But it was just like all that kind of technology that we didn't have. I mean, you wanted a mixtape, you had to wait for the song to come on the radio, but all those things. Yeah. We rode our bikes.
Everybody shut up!
we rode our bikes everywhere. I mean, so I don't, there's that. I also,
it's funny because Tammy Pescatelli said last week she would do an animated show too.
Because you don't got to worry about, like, if the show's a hit and everybody likes it, you can do it for the rest of your life.
Bill Burr's got that cartoon too.
Family. Yeah, because that's what they want. I mean, you know, look at how long has been the guys for South Park. I mean, that show's been on for like 19 years.
I was in high school. It's longer than that.
And they're still at it. And they still, like, you know, they really like that. I mean, they really do, like, you know, go after, like, they cover everything. They attack it from all sides. It's a great show. It's funny as hell, you know. That would be, because you wouldn't have to worry about getting older. You could just go do that show and make the quiet money. Really, you just do the voiceover stuff for it.
Yeah.
But I would do an animated show.
You know how funny it would be to hear a kid, like a little cartoon kid with like Jimmy's voice?
Yeah, exactly. I would narrate it, and then my character would have my voice.
Yeah.
even though he was a kid.
That'd be really funny.
Yeah, and so, yeah. But, you know, and for the edgier stuff, would go with some of my dad's, like, detective stories, you know, about the, you know, about the finding of a human head. And anyway, they found the body.
That's a great angle.
And they go, but anyway, you kids sleep tight, and then we're just laying there with our eyes open.
I'll just take this human head to evidence tomorrow.
That's kind of, that would be something I'd be interested in. I'm actually working on a project with a buddy of mine about a kid who's a referee.
Awesome.
He's a referee. His dad's a legendary high school basketball coach, you know, and so this kid thought he was going to play in the NBA, but he was 5'7", and he's a white dude. He was a great high school basketball player, but that's where he thought he was going to, but didn't work out. So now he winds up getting a job as a ref, and he's coaching 8-year-old girls, not really taking it seriously. He's kind of doing it with a hangover, and he's a gambling degenerate, and then something happens. We haven't figured it out, but then he starts to take it seriously, and basically realizes there's more than one way to get to the NBA. You can get there as a ref. Mm-hmm. And so it changes the whole dynamic. It's called The Whistleblower. Mm-hmm. And it's about a referee. And it's like an everyman's kind of sports story where the guy, I mean, the end of the movie is him running out of the tunnel, but it's just like, he goes, ref, he's traveling. He goes, they're all traveling. They're 8 years old. You know, like he's yelling at his parents and stuff. And so, yeah, it was, me and my buddy Jason are kind of like punching that up right now, kind of working on it. But yeah.
One of the things I've realized about anybody who has any modicum of success in stand up or in entertainment, there's a skill, there's a preparation, but there's also luck, right? Like, always luck's a huge part of it. If you had to, like, look back and think about your career over the last 25 years, 30 years, where do you think the luckiest break was for you? Just that happenstance that really set something off.
Getting that movie Go was a big deal. I'd just gotten back from my...
You were Vic the Bouncer, right?
Yeah, Vic the Bouncer, and I kind of auditioned for that, and they called me back, but it was also, I'd just gotten back to Philadelphia, and my Uncle Joe had lost his son, Joey. He was like 12, and so it was really a tough time. And I just didn't give a shit. And I went in, and I had the thing down. I had the original read on it, and then the casting director gave me the wrong notes. And the guy said, he goes, look, and I just, he goes, remember, you get shot here. And I went in, and I fucking threw the chair down. I was kicking the chair, you know. And I walked out, and I didn't even give a shit. I didn't care what happened. It was the last thing I cared about was getting the movie, and I wound up getting it. Mm-hmm. And I got to work with Doug Liman, and I got to work with Jay Moore, and Sarah Polley, and Katie Holmes, and Screamin' Freeman, the guy who was the Dane in Miller's Crossing, mm-hmm. who was great to work with, you know, and I realized that, like, you know, like, it's so funny because he goes, you smoke, like, weed? I go, yeah. And so went to Australia, we smoked a joint. But while he was smoking weed, he was giving me all these great little acting tips, like to open yourself up to the camera. Let's say the guy, he goes, if the guy's shooting over this shoulder and they're coming in, he goes, you should take your right eye and look, open it up so you're looking your right eye to his right eye, and it opens you up to camera. Yeah. He goes, if you're doing over here, you do it from this eye to that eye, and it just opens you up to camera. And there's little things that are techniques like you would not know, and Screaming Freeman. But he was giving me all these great little things, and I just got into the conversation. And then he knocked on the door. He goes, "You guys ready?" And I freaked out because I was high now. And it was just a pickup shot. They were just establishing us. But after that, it became known as acting lessons. Like, anytime anyone wants to smoke pot, he goes, you want some acting lessons? Because that's what I said. I was like, he gave me the grace. So he goes, we would do acting lessons. But James Duval was a kid that was in that. And some cool friendships that I'm still friends with today. Like, you know, folks like that. And Jay Moore was in it, you know. And it was a great little project. You know, I just did a movie called Puppy Love by this great director named Michael Maxis that Hopper Penn's in it. Sean Penn's son is the lead in it.
No fooling.
But Michael Madsen's in it, and Roseanne Arquette, and Wayne Newton's in it, and a wife beater. And also Cowboy Cerrone from the USC plays the big brother.
Do you do any scenes with Wayne Newton?
No, my scenes are all with Hopper.
Okay. You know? Very cool.
And so and my scenes frame it because he goes back to tell the stories. But we're sitting in a hot tub at this, like, community pool, and he's just telling these stories, and they fade back, and they kind of like
do. So you're the present day anchor.
But I'm actually the audience. I'm what you would. He was telling, because he's telling these stories, and so you would represent the audience. But it's already, they got a lot of interest in it.
Puppy love.
Yeah, and I think that they'll you can IMDb it. But yeah, that was fun to do. I mean, you know, I have a good time acting when they let me, you know. But I take it seriously. You know, I'd love to be able to like be creative in other ways, you know.
Viewer question. We'll also give a nice shout out to Lisa and Ryan Feeney. Ryan Feeney apparently is your very biggest fan.
Is that right?
That's it. Ryan Feeney is your
Prove
dude.
It.
Nice.
He loves you.
Well, I love him because he loves me.
Jimmy, welcome to Rochester. We love the Carlson. My husband is your biggest fan. Hopefully we don't get a blizzard while you're here. Our weather is terrible. Yada, yada, yada. Small talk. Are you going to get a garbage plate while you are in Rochester?
You know,
you've been here, coming here for years. Have you tried the garbage plate?
Yeah, I've had the garbage plate. You know, I always get the garbage plate. But you know what? I got to tell you, I love those Tony D ribs. I mean, I dream about those ribs.
Yeah, they're
like,
good.
I mean, they got the right amount of heat. They got the right amount of sweet. You get that kind of salty, savory. I mean, for me, it just falls off the bone. It's just amazing. Those meatballs are ridiculous. Those wings are ridiculous. So when I'm here, I can't help it. I just go, I'll probably have like, you know, garbage plate's a garbage plate, you know, but I just love those Tony D ribs, man.
Amazing.
We are not a city for those that diet.
Yeah, not a lot of diet. Like the East Coast cities, like you go to Chicago, and got deep dish pizza, you know. You go to Cleveland, they got the panini,
yep.
And you got Parami Brothers and thing. You got the cheesesteaks in Philly, you know. It's all, you got the Monfilato down in New Orleans. It's like, you know, everybody's got their food.
These cities are so proud of like the way we kill you with cholesterol. We're just so proud of it.
Yeah, well, it's food, man.
Yeah,
you know, it's just you know, I mean, come on. As long as you don't eat it breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, for me,
that's the best part of a garbage plate. It's a little bit of everything.
Yeah. And the other thing is, too, is like, you know, I really, when I'm home, I eat super healthy, man. I make spinach omelets. And I love to cook. I mean, I absolutely love to cook. So I'll go to the store and I'll get all healthy stuff. I have yogurts and bananas. I'll make smoothies. I put chia seeds in my yogurt. I mean, I eat really healthy. I drink tons of water. I usually get up in the morning and do a 2 to 3 mile walk. You know, I'm usually listening to my books on tape. I'll come home, I'll practice magic for about an hour, maybe an hour and a half. I'll sit down and I'll start to do some work. I'll do some writing, but I'll like, you know, get a workout in, and then I start to like, you know, make my business calls and send my emails out and do my thing. Yeah, I love if I can stay home for extended periods of time. It's just, you just traveling all the time, it just beats you up. I'm getting too old for this. I mean, I got another couple of years of me and figure it out. Who knows? Maybe they'll let me act on a TV show and I can go, yeah, and then go out when I want to go out. But
when you do that cartoon show, I'll be glad to do the voice of any of the fat friends that you need.
Well, actually, I did have this African-American kid that we were growing up. He was a ventriloquist, and I was a magician, and we kind of hung out.
Fine, I'll play him.
You know what? But you know what's funny? He didn't. He didn't have an African-American dummy. He had this white dummy, but he would put blackface on the white dummy so he could, you know. It's so funny.
That's the only time I think blackface is technically okay.
It might be.
Yeah.
You might have cracked it.
So,
Justin Trudeau.
But then the stuff would wear off, and he, you know, put the burnt cork on it, and then it would wear off, and it looked like the dummy was a coal miner coming out of the shaft, you know.
Oh, shit. All right, Jimmy, I'm going to let you get out of here, but I have one last question for you, and this is one that I like to ask everybody because we have so many young comedians that watch the show. They want advice.
Yeah.
Very simple. It's 2020. If you had to restart, if you didn't have the career you had, if you had to, in 2020, knowing everything that you know about the comedy business, where would you start? Where do you think the best spot to get ahead is?
Well, I would worry about, like, you know, creating an act first. And,
sure.
And you can do that anywhere. But I would study the greats. I would also, you know, a lot of people do this today. You see this a lot in Los Angeles, where a lot of these young comics put the social media cart before the horse.
Yeah.
I would say develop an act. And it's all writing. It's all writing. Writing and stage time and 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 writing and stage time gets you there quicker. The more stage time, the better you'll be. Because it takes you about 4 years to become who you authentically are on stage. It just does. By the time it's like a lot like being a stripper, except you undress mentally. You let people see how you think and feel about stuff. And there really are only 8 joke formulas of how, you know, you approach a bit and you talk about stuff.
And odds are no one's giving you a dollar.
But at the end of the day, the product is the stand-up. Mm-hmm. But I'm not saying don't do social media. I'm saying be really responsible with it. Because you look at today, look at Ari Shaffir.
Yeah.
I mean, he's in trouble now because he said that thing about Kobe. Even though that's his stand-up, though. He's a very mean-spirited kind of thing. That's what he does. But it just didn't sit well with people. And so he's kind of fucked up his career a little bit. My buddy Brad Williams, like, they tried to Me Too him on a story he told about Carlos Mencia.
I was talking to Brad the day before that hit because he had a baby.
Yeah.
He had a brand new baby. I sent him a nice congratulations. So, next thing I know.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is there's a tremendous amount of pressure on comedians to come up with funny stories and different stuff. And we just live in a different era. I mean, I've had a career for 30 years. But when I was doing all my dumb stuff, there was no social media. So
yeah.
I'm glad for that. But I mean, you have to be cognizant and aware of it. Like, yeah, a lot of these guys think they're edgy for edgy's sake. Look, let me tell you something. You can do that, but there's plenty of guys who do it really well, like Doug Stanhope.
Mm-hmm.
Is amazing. He's prolific.
You do it pretty damn well.
Yeah, but I also do corporate stuff. Like, I can just shift gears and I can go to a corporate event where I don't drop any F-bombs and I just do my act, because those pay extremely well for comedians. I've been doing for the last maybe month and a half, I had a corporate event and then I would do a comedy club, but a corporate event, a comedy club, and corporate. So it basically turns you're making good money.
Wants to pay me not to say fuck, sign me up.
Well, you know, the job at the end of the day is to make people laugh. That's your job.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to figure out a way to do that you feel comfortable with, that you're not selling out. So I would say, I would just say work on your stand-up. Be careful with your social media. You know, I'm sure some people think, hey, it doesn't make a difference what they're saying as long as they're talking about me. I go, yeah, but, you know, there's, like, I wouldn't want to become famous like that. I want to become famous for all the right reasons, I mean, I don't want, otherwise, what are you going to do? You want to become famous? You know, go take a shot at the president or something, and then you become famous, you know what I mean? I mean, I don't know.
Not necessarily a strategy we are endorsing.
No, we're not endorsing. Right. No, we're not endorsing. I'm just saying, like, you know, you want to become famous, like, and people want to. I don't. People want to become famous. Like, you don't want to be a great stand-up. You just want to be famous.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't want to be a great stand-up. You want to be famous.
Yeah.
I would say be a great stand-up, and that would take care of all the other stuff. I think if you do the work on the stand-up, all those other things will fall into place.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I mean, you just be undeniable. Like, you know, Bill Burr said, just be undeniable. Just be the funniest guy in Rochester. And then once you're the funniest guy here, then you can take it to a bigger market like Chicago, mm-hmm. that has a great scene. And I would not go to LA or New York unless you have an agent or a manager
or something lined up,
because you're really just going to get lost in the shovel. I mean, people move to LA now and you can't get spots. You're not going to get spots at the Improv. No. You're not going to get spots at the Comedy Store. I mean, there's also Flappers. There's also the Ice House. But I mean, you know, you should be, I mean, moving to LA with only a couple years experience in stand-up is the equivalent of trying to climb Mount Everest without ever taking a climbing lesson.
Yeah.
It's the difference from going, like, being a big local guy in a town like, say, I don't know, Kansas City or some of these places, or, like, you know, Florida, and then you go to New York or LA, it's like you're playing college ball, and now you just jumped up to the pros. And unless you are, you know, you can do 45 minutes, you have a successful podcast or stuff like that, you're just going to get lost in the shuffle and you're going to be fucking miserable. I mean, most of the stuff they're casting now are casting out of Atlanta. They're shooting 60 to 80 television shows out of Atlanta now.
Yeah.
So all those shows that I would be reading for are getting cast and are being cast locally in Atlanta. So, I mean, you know, kind of Hollywood's kind of shifted a little bit and moved out there. But, I mean, everything's streaming now anyway. You see a lot of these people on these Netflix shows. And as soon as the show's done, they got to go get a regular job because they're not – the shows aren't paying what they want. It's the, you know, it's those, what they call them, streaming.
It's the amount.
The new media contracts. But, yeah, but, I mean, you know, so it doesn't make a difference. But, I mean, you know, like you said, those people probably just love to act or create a character. And for them, it's different. But, I mean, you know, I grew up with the golden age SAG where, you know, you go do a guest star on a show. You get topics and you go in Monday for the table read and you'd film it Friday night and boom. And you'd make a nice paycheck, and then you get paid twice because they'd re-air it in the season. So you get, then you get your residual check, and then you usually got your insurance. You know, now to be able to make that kind of money off a show, you'd have to really you work twice as hard for half the money. And so show, and you know, but it's also, you know, with social media, you have a direct line to a fan base. And if you, and if you, and look, and I didn't grow up with it. I mean, I really had to kind of learn how to do it on the fly. But, you know, people go to my, you know, Jimmy Schubert at Instagram or Twitter and stuff like that. And I just, I don't, I'm not a big fan of Twitter. I think Twitter is just all a bunch of hateful, you know, losers.
I'm getting kind of tired of Twitter myself.
Yeah, honestly. It's like, it's, you know, I like Instagram because it's pictures. Yeah. You put your stuff up. People, they just click them.
Same reason I like comic books.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then
that's because you can't
and
read.
Then, and then I have a Facebook fan page that you know, you kind of monitor. But I need to work on my YouTube channel a little bit. But, yeah, I don't, I mean, at one point I go, well, Jesus, how much information do people need to know about you? It's like, hey, this week on the Jimmy Schubert show, I'm going to swallow this little camera. You guys are going to take a ride through my lower intestine, and whoever guesses the correct amount of polyps on my lower GI gets 4 free tickets to my next show at the MB Improv.
I like how you don't
13.
Say 13. I like how you say the correct amount. You don't say if there are or aren't polyps. You're just assuming that they're going to be.
I know there's not. Like I just got that done recently.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
You got to take that all that stuff, and you just, you know, and then the guy gets that little mask. I go, you know, just like because they take whatever that thing is. I'm not really, I don't know, you know, and then they take an air hose and blow out your front and then put the camera in there and it's like, you know, and then everybody's laying in recovery just like farting all that air out of their fucking front. Everybody's just laying in recovery just farting, but you're just talking and then you're out and then you're waking up going, wow, I didn't feel a thing.
Jeez.
You know?
So 4 more shows this weekend with Jimmy Schubert, ladies and gentlemen. Tickets are available now. Jimmy, till the next time.
Yeah, man. Thank you very much for having me on.
You're legitimately one of our favorites. So.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that.
Thank you. We'll be back with the news with Ross Johnson. Make sure you get your tickets now, Jimmy Schubert.
That's right, because we're going to sell out, people.
Hell yeah. Thank you for being awesome and watching another episode of the Carlson Cast. Don't forget we're streaming live on Facebook and YouTube every Friday morning. You could also follow us on social media on Twitter and Instagram at CarlsonCast. You can listen anytime on iTunes, Google Play, and we're now available on Spotify. You should also check out an amazing app called Laughable. And on the Laughable app, you can connect to your favorite comedians in a way you never thought you could before. Download it in the App Store and visit CarlsonCast.com for information on more shows. And don't be a jerk. Rate and review. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is that time where we talk about what is going on in the world of stand-up comedy. That's right. When stand-up news breaks, I usually let Ross know about it. Then he pretends to tell you and tell me like I've never heard it before.
At least a week later. I actually didn't get your email this week, so I don't really have anything. If we could just vamp for like 20 minutes, that'd be great.
Great. Cancel.
Okay.
Where are we starting today?
Okay, so we're gonna talk about Ari Shaffir. I think we've been clued in this on this one already.
There was a ruckus.
So this is the if you don't know who this is, so this is the producer and co-host of the Skeptic Tank podcast. He's been on Joe Rogan. He's on Joe Rogan a bunch of times. He does Punch Drunk Sports podcast. He does a bunch of stuff. But he was scheduled to perform this past Tuesday at the New York Comedy Club. When people got wind of a tweet that he had sent out about
you shouldn't make jokes about strong gusts of wind while we're talking about what we're talking about.
Good point. That's a fair point. Let me redo that.
Yeah, so, you shouldn't laugh at me saying that either.
Oh God!
You need to get us all canceled.
Death threats already.
All right.
He had made some references to Kobe Bryant's passing on his Twitter account.
He said, "R.I.P. One of the best basketball players ever.
The legend.
Right."
Yeah, and people were upset about that. He made some. I don't know if I want to read it.
Why don't you read the tweet, Ross?
Everybody
the tweet, Ross.
Zoom in real close on Ross's face as he reads this.
All right, I am quoting. This is from TMZ had this because his Twitter account is now private. He said, blah 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 blah. Kobe Bryant I can't get it out because I'm afraid for my life. Kobe Bryant died 23 years ago, 23 years too late today. He got away with rape because all the Hollywood liberals who attack comedy enjoy rooting for the Lakers more than they dislike rape. Big ups to the hero who forgot to gas up his chopper. I hate the Lakers. This is a great day. That was a quote. Yeah. That was not my... I was at the gas station. I was at the gas station like yesterday, and the guy working behind the counter was crying because the other person working behind the counter had brought up Kobe Bryant, and he was like, "I can't even believe you brought that up right now. I can't even." So, emotions are running high.
He just played basketball, as far as I'm aware, right? He was really good at the basketball.
He was good at the basketball.
He won an Academy Award last year.
Yeah,
for that movie that he produced.
About the basketball.
About basketball, correct.
Yeah.
So anyway, just to wrap up the details with this real quick. So the club was receiving a lot of threats, which were reported to the police. The police are investigating. The club canceled his performance. He had performed there before. The club canceled his performance and basically said, they didn't comment a lot, but they're like, no, we're done with him. Sounded like forever. So
it was a bit crass and way too soon, but I will say, I bet there are a lot of people who feel exactly the same way. That just aren't saying anything.
There was a reporter who was suspended. I forget which news organization it was, but there was a reporter who was suspended for day of tweeting about the guy got away with rape.
Brian's phone just buzzed, and I'm pretty sure it was a death threat.
I just sent it. It was from me. I'm going to kill you, you unfunny asshole. Okay.
And for comedy news, we don't need to get too into this. But yeah, there was a lot of... there was a lot of discussion, I think, on social media and stuff about, like, how much to talk about the entirety of Kobe Bryant's life versus,
the overwhelming majority.
Acquitted, we have to say he was. Well, the charges were thrown out.
He sort of admitted.
It was a settlement.
It was a complicated thing. Yeah. But yeah.
All I'm trying to say is that the overall majority of the guy's career was very positive. He was a beloved player. He only wore two uniforms his whole career. He was Lakers and the United States Olympic team. Mm-hmm. He had that one big thing that happened, and he was accused of rape. What do you want me to tell you? I didn't have anything to do with it. The guy was accused of rape. Charges were brought against him for mentioning it. I don't think that's a crime.
Yeah,
it's maybe not in the best of taste. Now, I understand why they would cancel his show. I get that. I understand if they're getting death threats.
It's for
to
his
the building,
own safety, really.
Right.
Yeah.
My question is going to be, is how far is this going to be taken? Is it going to be, we're never booking him again?
Well, and I guess we'll find out what happens to his career. I have a hard time, maybe I'm giving too much credit. I have a hard time believing, and he did apologize, by the way. He has said, look, this is a thing that I do when people die, and I sort of didn't.
You should have seen my grandma's obituary.
Basically. I don't know anything about the guy. I don't know how good he is or anything like that. But you would hope that this is maybe not by itself a career killer. I guess we'll see.
This has me scratching my head because generally when you say something racist, like we take the Shane Gillis situation with SNL, mm-hmm. he made jokes about a race of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I get that. This guy made a joke about one guy who died.
And I don't think it was really even a joke. I think he was actually legitimately upset.
Well, that's it too. I mean, there wasn't really a joke there. It was just sort of a statement.
It was a troll. It was a funny troll. That was the point of it. It was like basically what he was trying to do is get the people who follow him to react.
Yeah.
He wanted people to go, "Oh, come on, Ari. All right, Ari. Yeah. Oh, Ari, he's nothing but consistent."
Well,
you know?
This is the flip side too with a lot of this stuff, even the less extreme examples. You do something to get a reaction, and then you get a reaction. You know what I mean? You can't always control how the reaction's going to be. So,
100%.
You know, it's interesting. On the one hand, you say, oh, why do people react so strongly? On the other hand, the person wanted you to react strongly. They just didn't, you know, they just weren't able to control the blowback.
Right.
So.
And the whole principle of stand-up comedy is you are creating a reaction
right
out of nowhere. Your goal is to create a stimuli versus reaction. So he's doing what a comic does. Maybe he should have saved it for the right audience.
Yeah, should have held it beat. You know? Yeah.
Well, and again, I guess.
He would look like a real dickhead if, like, 2 weeks later he tweeted
that.
Yeah,
I guess you're right. That's
all
a good
I'm saying.
Point. Yeah, you're right.
Well, and maybe, you know, if you're not, like, usually into basketball or Kobe, I think people also underestimate the amount of emotion people have about this. And it was, even if you're not into basketball, I mean, it was a very tragic event. I mean, with Donner,
there,
and with other
we
people
live
in the
Rochester,
you know.
New York. There were billboards in Rochester, New York. Those electronic billboards that switch, they had Mamba out on them. They had like,
oh, wow. Okay.
By Kobe. They lit up the Empire State Building, purple and gold. Lakers colors in New York.
Yeah.
Like that's who you joked about, Ari.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry to tell you, bud. And not that I care that he made a joke about Sony being dead. It doesn't really change my radar or my opinion of the guy because I know who he is and I know what he's about.
Yeah.
But when you're a guy on the cusp, like Ari's on the cusp. Ari's not a household name, but real comedy fans know Ari.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Definitely. I mean, so he's not a super huge act, but I think any momentum that he had going forward is definitely going to stall. I just hope this isn't like a career ender for him.
Yeah.
All right. All what right. else we got today?
So that was the big news. So the rest is fairly positive. Kobe Bryant dead. That's number two. Did you guys hear about Kobe Bryant? Please don't send me death threats. So Andy Samberg, turns out he's doing pretty well these days. So at Sundance, the biggest deal ever in the history of the film festival. By 69 cents.
Sandberg got the biggest deal out of Sundance.
So his movie Palm Springs, Hulu and Neon teamed up to buy it for $17.5 million and 69 cents.
Sexy.
Which beats the 2016 Birth of a Nation that they bought for $17.5 million. So they went 69 cents over to buy this Palm Springs movie. I didn't give you the rundown, but it's like a Groundhog Day romantic comedy type of thing.
Like Groundhog Day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, last year, the big winners were Amazon bought Late Night and Brittany Runs a Marathon for $13 and $14 million. So, I guess that gives you an example of how
that Brittany
much
runs
this
a marathon
money pays off.
Brittany Runs a Marathon was in theaters too, wasn't it?
I don't know that for a fact.
I'm pretty sure it was because my wife runs and like that's her hobby, and she saw the preview for that and like lost her mind.
Oh. Okay, I think she was the one.
That's okay, yeah, she was the one. What are you trying to do to me, Ross?
Yeah. And the Birth of a Nation 2016 was doing well until again comes back to some rape type, sexual assault type stuff going on there. So you know, we'll see if this pays off. But so far, the record of studios paying big money for these things is not great.
Yeah.
But hopefully, you know, it sounds like a cute, fun movie, though. And yeah.
Here's the thing, though. If you were to produce a movie, what's it going to cost you?
I think like $300. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. Like, I don't know.
It's a lot. Yeah.
That's in my...
Is that the budget?
If you asked me to produce a movie with my entire savings, yeah, that would be about
it. Well, because your movies are usually about 8 minutes long and people only watch the first three.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, for $300, you could have Brian in an Abe's parking lot. This is what you could have for $300. Be good. Good stuff. So, I mean, it costs millions of dollars to produce a movie.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you could pay for it and save the deal, the trouble of, like, the difference between producing a movie yourself and buying a movie like this is at least you get to see the finished product before you invest.
Right.
So... we'll see.
And it's doing film festivals, so other people have seen it, so presumably there's some kind of, you have some sense of how the reaction is going to be already. So, you know, we'll see.
Right on.
It sounds cute. I don't know.
Yeah, that's always a good way to, it sounds cute.
Well, you know.
Money in the bank.
So finally, wrapping up, just on a very light note, since we'll start off a little heavy, Jerry Seinfeld has a new book coming out. This is his first book.
Look at that forced smile on that picture.
Yeah. I think most of his smiles are pretty forced. I don't know if he's a genuinely...
I bet you that man, when he's in his home, just stares straight ahead and doesn't talk to anybody.
What's the deal with walls?
He just stands there annoyed about tripping over all the piles of cash that are laying around.
Oh my God, who left this here?
you left 20 grand in the foyer again.
It's a stack of 50s. Toss it on the street.
His last book was 27 years ago. He's got a new book coming out later this year. It's going to be, it's currently untitled, but the premise is that it will follow Seinfeld's joke writing career decade by decade, starting when he was a college student. Seinfeld explains that he kept old school accordion folders of every funny thing he thought on stage while writing or just in conversation for 45 years, and used that to put this book together. So, I don't know how that sounds to me, but, you know, I'm sure he'll make a lot of money because he can't step out the door without making a lot of money. So,
yeah.
Good for him.
So, in essence, it's a biography. It's an autobiography.
Or, like, just old index cards. I don't know. Like, here are funny things I thought on stage that I did not put into my act, that I did not think were funny enough to put into an act, but I saved for this book that I'm going to sell you. So,
Is it supposed to be, like, the B-sides? Like, what is he doing
here? I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. You know what? I'm sure it'll be fascinating. And from
and a, I'm
from
sure
a
it'll
comedy
be great.
Insider point of view, I'm sure it'll be fascinating. Like, if you want to... Yeah. I have a feeling there's going to be good stuff about the making of the, you know, making the sausage
sure.
of comedy.
Sure. Well, I will definitely read that. Seinfeld's new book. When is it coming out? Do we know?
Later this year. Yeah, it's awesome. not dated yet.
So, folks, that's the news this week. Thank you. Thank you for tuning into this edition of the Comedy the Carlson Cast. Remember, tell a friend. Please rate and review. We always appreciate that. 5 stars. If you're nasty, we'd appreciate it. And
if you're nasty,
we want those 5 stars.
Remember, anything less than 5 stars, and our manager will come and talk to us. So
yeah, and that's Shoeless Joe. Yeah. We'll lecture all of us.
Yeah.
So we'll be back next week. We're very, very excited. Until then, act right. See you next time.